oftentimes when I'm working with a brand, we're talking about the brand as an ecosystem of either objects or experiences, or sometimes both, and sometimes digital and sometimes physical or all. And you do need to assess each one of those nodes in the system to make sure it's doing what that particular moment needs to do for the product, the consumer, the experience, whatever, make it differentiated and elevated and so on. But then you have to get the thing to move again, and so that it's a collection of all of these things.
Hi, everyone. Today, we're in for a treat as we spotlight Katie Drakey, the founder of Drakey, D-R-K-E, and a seasoned brand strategist with an impressive background and global experience. Katie has lent her expertise to renowned companies such as Nike, Droga5, Adidas, White & Kennedy, and IDEO. These days, Katie's on a mission at Drakey, crafting, sculpturing, and shaping living brands for the long term, believing in future-focused, ethically driven strategies that contribute positively to culture, society, and the planet. Katie's more than just a brand strategist. She's a Pacific Northwest native with a passion for science fiction and the great outdoors. Her diverse experience, healthy sense of humor, and her sunny disposition have been key to her success. So whether you're a fellow sci-fi fan, an outdoor enthusiast, or someone intrigued by the future of branding, this one's for you.
Katie, yeah. So great to have you today. You are a global strategy and innovation. You have a consultancy. You're a thought leader on various social media platforms. You have an incredible career working with everybody from Nike to White & Kennedy and a few others. Normally, we like to start talking to guests from the beginning leading up until now. But since you're doing so many interesting things today, can you just tell us a little bit more about what you're doing now and then maybe how those experiences eventually helped get you to where you are today?
Yeah. Hello, I'm Katie Drakey. I'm in Portland, Oregon this morning. It's raining, surprise. I run my little kingdom here from my home office. I started 3 years ago. So actually it's a good time to kind of check in with myself. What am I doing? I've been doing it for the last 3 years, whatever it is I've been doing. And it's something I always wanted to try, meaning being my own decision maker, giving agency to myself, giving a chance to kind of make all the decisions that I watched other people make for a while, and some of which I disagreed with, but had no like control of the scenario. Now it's like, hey, I've been in and out of all these different environments. I have an idea of what I think is another way to navigate this world, and to actually kind of reorient the conversation around certain topics, force reassessments and recalibrations around certain things that are kind of important to me, and also things that I think people don't get enough time to think about on the daily with normal business pressures. And so I kind of stuck my toe in the water of kind of being I guess I describe it as being an independent. I had people immediately ask me when I left Nike in 2020, so what are you going to do? Are you going to build an agency? What are you going to build your agency around? And I just, having worked in agencies and being really familiar with sort of the traditional agency model, I didn't want to create anything like that. I mean, as much as I learned so many great gifts from that style of operating, meaning a lot of diversity, a lot of nimbleness, a lot of speed, incredible creativity, the business model is flawed in my mind and probably run its course. And I was not interested in replicating that in any way, shape, or form. And what I decided I was building was an idea. And it was more about people I hoped would hire me because they like the way I think. They like the particular view I have on the world. They recognize that I have a track record of getting things done and making impact, not just waxing philosophically, which I also like to do, but like waxing philosophically with teeth in it, you know, and an idea of like what it takes in terms of money and numbers of bodies, effort, sequencing of time, order of operations, expected outcomes, all of those things. I'm lucky enough to have done tours of duty along the spectrum so I can stitch it together for people. And I decided that I didn't want to have employees, but I wanted to have a lot of collaborators. And so I wanted to be a little bit like a quarterback for a really talented team, or like an international space station where a lot of people would come and dock their ships for a while, and we'd have incredible, you know, thinking parties and making parties. And I wanted there to be a certain degree of like magnetism to what I was creating, which forced me then to think about how I was making it different from what other people might be saying and doing out there. And to be honest, I think like anybody in the beginning, I was really like self-analytical, maybe in a hyper-analytical sort of way, or maybe even in a slightly negative sort of way, like nobody's going to really buy this shit, and you know, like just really pushing myself to try to make it be really and truly something else. And I did two really interesting little experiments in the very, very beginning, like in the first 6 months. One was I contacted, I think it was about 50 people, and I asked them all the same question. It was just one question. And it was a people I had worked with, a couple people who were actually like best friends or family members. And then also people who I kind of knew, like we both worked at the same company, but maybe not on the same team. And so we were aware of each other. Intentionally choosing people close to me and with distance. And I asked them all, answer with one word, answer with a sentence, answer with whatever you'd like, but what about me is memorable to you? And I just wanted to get an idea, like a quick snapshot of what makes me stick in other people's minds. And what came back from that was just, thankfully, the things I kind of wanted to hear, which is just, you look at the world differently. You're so accessible and open. You share a lot. You're silly and you make the work fun. It's nice to see a woman doing this work, or it's nice to see a mom doing this work. That's some of the stuff that came back. So it was like a wide variety, but like really basically reinforcing some of the things that I kind of knew about myself, but I actually hadn't gotten in tangible feedback before. And then the other thing I did is I have this dear friend, Sarah, and she is also, I mean, she's a brand marketer. She's a strategist. She also at one point became trained as a coach. And I don't think she's doing it intentionally, but every time we hang out, she is just the best listener. And she always doesn't answer my questions, but responds to my questions with a question, as a really good strategist should do, and provokes really critical thinking in the way that I have been building what I've been doing. And she was able to say back to me, what I observe when you talk about the things that you really love is you literally glow. Like you're just, your eyes are doing something different. Your voice sounds different. Your posture shifts. Your energy is, she's like, if you can just do the most you can to find a way of making income off of the things that make you do that, you're going to have a great time. But I was like, I just don't know if there's a market for this kind of stuff. Like it always just feels like a fun thing because it's a fun thing. And she's like, I think you can find it if you look for it. And so I just have been, you know, kind of intentionally doing, kind of trading off of the back of, you know, 20 plus years of global advertising, communications, branding, innovation work, all the while slowly watching this little meter on this internal dashboard I have inside my head, trying to make more and more each year be a little bit closer to kind of that place where I'd really just like to spend the majority of my time aglow. So anyway, that's the long journey. But in the meantime, I needed to pay the bills, and my daughter just started college, and I've got a son who's going to be graduating in a year. And so there was the practicalities of, I no longer am receiving a paycheck every month. And so I need to figure out how to replace those dollars, or maybe even do better. Quite naturally, some of the first things I did is actually plug into other agencies because I wanted to see what they were up to. Oh, and of course, like the elephant in the room is all this happened in 2020. So I also left a corporate organization where I'd been at Nike for 7 years and was like, okay, so what's going on out here? It's shit went crazy. And it certainly had an impact inside of Nike, which is a very analog culture. A lot of face-to-face, a lot of workshops, a lot of offsites, a lot of, if you got to get things done, you got to ride your bike across campus and talk to somebody. So it was a real struggle the last year that I was there during 2020 to do the regular routines through the screen. They've obviously learned how to do that, like everybody else learned how to do it, but it was tough. And so I kind of stumbled out of the corporate environment and kind of shook it all off and then was like, what's going on out here now? And I found it's like, this is great because I can actually do stakeholder interviews almost easier this way because I have a person who I am talking to through the screen, who can't get up and walk away, who can't check their phone because I'll see them, you know, who, like all this stuff where it's like I can talk to a CEO who is at home in their house while I'm at home in my house. And we can start the conversation by talking about what a wild experience we're both going through, which connects us emotionally as human beings straight out the gate. If I was doing this stuff 5-10 years ago, I would fly somewhere, I'd get a badge, go into some tower, wait around for someone to make time for the conversation. They'd be distracted. They'd probably cut it off short, maybe even reschedule it. You know, like, so I just kind of felt like this was a portal into a new way of working. And I just happened to be embedded in the moment of its genesis. And I was just going to ride this wave and learn it and then try to see what I could do with it, you know, that was unique. And, so it kind of just took off. Yeah, please.
Just because I've heard so many great things, and I want people when they're listening to hear what I'm hearing. I think what was fascinating about how you kicked all this off is I really get the feeling, and I would encourage this with young designers or young professionals or young creatives anywhere, is this spirit of experimentation and exploration. So having the courage to kind of step away and say, well, I know it doesn't want to be an agency. I don't want it to be, but what could it be? And then going down that path of asking friends, you know, your brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room. So I think that's kind of a really rich exercise for anyone to do. And I've heard people say that. I'm personally too afraid to do that because I know the comments that are going to come back. So it won't be too fun. And then, and just back to the shift that happened in COVID and you observing this new way of working that we're all adapting to today, like having a podcast on three different corners of the world in different time zones and being able to talk simultaneously. Mm. I read Shoe Dog, the Phil Knight book, and at the start of Nike's inception, you know, they were writing letters to companies in Japan and waiting 3 or 4 weeks to get a response. And, you know, so the way in which we're doing business today, versus 10 years ago is a big enough shift, but versus 20, 30, 40 years ago is cataclysmic. Is that the right word? Or it's just insanely different. So we can only imagine where we're heading. So.
Totally.
And I'll get off my soapbox.
And I'm gonna follow that up too. I think you first of all, you covered a lot of great ground there, Katie, and you followed that up wonderfully, Brendan. Because a big thing that I think you're very keen to, Katie, is just future focused brands, future focused experiences, transformations. And I think this sort of fit perfectly at that time for you, just to be able to anticipate, okay, what's the empathy level of this new experience? So how can you just talk a little bit more? You have an awesome landing page for anybody listening, drke.co, that is the home base for your consultancy. You have a messaging at the top, confidential engagements for the transformational age. Can you talk a little bit more about how this translates into some of these projects you work on with clients? And when you talk about You know, if somebody wants to connect with you and your personality, what does that look like in terms of manifestation and in the real world?
Yeah. I specifically chose that language because as a strategist, you often struggle to put together examples of your work because often what you're working on is pretty far upstream. And obviously your clients don't want anybody to know what they're working on for the next 2 or 3 years. And so it's a bit of a struggle in terms of what you're always asked to show. And instead of deciding to just, you know, woe is me about it, I thought, well, I'm just going to use that to my advantage and turn it into my weapon, which is like, I am working on confidential engagements, AKA, you know, the good stuff, the serious stuff, the secret sauce stuff. And it's not just next year's forecasting plan, which is like a 0.00001% change from previous year. It's the transformational stuff for this crazy ass age we're living in. And it was a little bit of like, put it on the table. We're all going through something crazy right now. And if you're not paying attention to that yet, then we probably shouldn't be talking. Because I only want to work with people who are paying attention, who are aware, self-aware enough to know that we are alive during a really unique time. And it's going to have its own challenges and it's also going to have its own opportunities. And that's the confidential work that I like to do. And then I just kind of felt like it also was a nice tight statement that captured what I wanted people to imagine about me as they were trying to make an assessment of whether they wanted to engage or not. You know, someone who can keep the confidentiality, someone who isn't going to show the work, someone who does want to operate at the highest level. Who brings the whole kit and caboodle of every experience from the past into the room and has the ability to imagine, you know, laterally. The logo on the page is moving, and that's actually an intentional thing too, with the idea that brands are not static objects and they need to imagine themselves in a multitude of different contexts. And so that requires a sort of organic sort of an understanding of a brand and that it is never finished and that it is living and breathing. It's much like a nervous system where it's sensing and but also providing sensory experiences to others as a way of communication and feedback. And if you hover your mouse over the logo at any point, it holds for the moment. And that's kind of just representing oftentimes when I'm working with a brand, we're talking about the brand as an ecosystem of either objects or experiences or sometimes both and sometimes digital and sometimes physical or all. And you do need to assess each one of those nodes in the system to make sure it's doing what that particular moment needs to do for the product, the consumer, the experience, whatever, make it differentiated and elevated and so on. But then you have to get the thing to move again and so that it's a collection of all of these things. So I was trying to really symbolically put some of my ideas into a crucible and shrink them into like little artifacts that somebody could bump up against and hopefully walk away with a really quick hit of or at a sensory level of like what the kind of work I would be provoking them to do together. And often what happens is I'll get a pretty straight ahead brief. Like even the work I've been doing with H&M over the last year started off with a straightforward brief. And I brought in a great partner. This guy actually brought me in. They contacted Britton first. He's a former planner from Wieden & Kennedy, Britton Taylor. He's also in Portland. We're friends. And this brief was big enough for the two of us to work on together. And it was pretty straightforward, which was we've lost our sort of brand center, our spiritual center. We've become much more of a retailer than a fashion brand, and we want to get back into the saddle again and, you know, assume our correct position and also feeling in the mind of the consumer. And, you know, that was a 3-month program where we did all this kind of the standard operating diagnostics you would around a brand, especially one that's over 80 years old and has done so many tours of duty around the world, and landed the brand platform, got it blessed and approved by the CEO up to the board, et cetera. But off the back of that came a bunch of other ones. So now that we've got this new brand position, what's our product engine philosophy? What are we making? Why are we making it? How are we making it? Who are we making it with? And what quantities are we making it? How do we communicate about sustainability? We're in a hot seat right now, along with all other fashion creators, when it comes to sustainability. But actually, what a lot of people don't realize is the decades of work that H&M have been making year in and year out on this topic. They're Swedish and they're humble and they don't know how to communicate these things. So there is a appetite from the consumer point of view to hear about the hard work you've been doing, to hear about how many years and how many people, and to hear from those people on what they've learned and the hard boulders they're trying to push on. So and then it led to, well, who do we hire and how do we train our in-store employees and what are the modules of experiences we want them to take on so they represent the brand to an eye-to-eye conversation with someone who walks into our store. So it started off as a straight ahead, how do we reposition our brand so we can be more competitive and have more of an emotional connection with people? But it functionally cascaded through all parts of the organization, including the loyalty program and how the loyalty program functions at like an engineering level. Like it just went through everything. So,
well, the brand essentially a brand is everything. It embodies everything, right? Every aspect of a business the people that work for you. So, it's exactly what it just unravels and opens up new opportunities that you don't realize that are there. I think if you're so close to it.
Right. And it empowered me. And hopefully, like if other people hear this, it will empower them to realize that often brand and marketing and creative folks, we are given maybe a discrete task. But because of our knowledge of what you just said, our understanding that it's all connected, if you are front-footed about it, if you're able to help your client see it as well, it can actually be that singular task can be the beginning of a much longer conversation. Mm. And it should.
We'd like to take a moment to remind you that Play & Conversations is brought to you by Play & Co. If you want to explore more about design opportunities, discover new insights, or connect with Play & Co. for a design project, be sure to visit playandco.com.
We definitely see that pattern forming with some of the work we're doing, right, guys? I'm curious, Simon, forgive me if I'm going off script, but there's something that you said earlier about the agency model being redundant now or dead or something like that. And you guys are two little almost like personal brands, or you're a personal brand that comes in and affects change at the executive level and works with companies at the executive level. Do you think we're in an era now where it's more effective to work that way, and I think gone are the days of, you know, big companies hiring big agencies just because they think that big teams should work together. Is there a breakdown there? Do you see that? Penny for your thoughts.
Yeah. If you think of the kind of traditional expected mode of an agency being, we've got to get a big client that can put us on a big retainer so we can hire a bunch of people and we can do the big work. And I would challenge that it needs to be a big client. I would challenge that it needs to be big work to be meaningful and actually the correct work. And I feel like I learned this even at Nike. Like there were a lot of leaders that had like big teams, 80 people, 150 people that were doing like large scale things. But I was also surprised. I was always running little ninja teams. Like I think the biggest team I ever had was 8 people. Yeah. But we were like hacking the system, and we would call our work like jujitsu moves in the dark and all this stuff. Like we sometimes that's actually where you're reading the matrix a little bit. You're listening to the whisper conversations in the walls. You're anticipating what is going to be needed, and you're getting there first because you're faster and smaller, and because you're just reading the room. You know, you're not tone deaf, and you're not actually following the process either, which sometimes gets you in trouble or it gets you in some tight spots. But if you deliver, the tight spots loosen up and they ask you to do it again and keep going. So I think what I'm finding especially when I talk to clients, like the fact that Britton and I were selected by a gigantic global brand called H&M, we didn't know until the end of the process when they called us to say, hooray, you've been selected. We didn't even know we were part of a pitch. Maybe we were just being naive and dumb about it, or maybe they told us and we didn't pick it up or something, but I think they actually didn't tell us. They were talking to other agencies, and those agencies were coming back with presentations of like, here's our team and here's the number of hours we're going to spend on your business. Mm-hmm. And when in the end, once I figured out what had happened, we had one of our status meetings and I was like, why did you guys pick us, by the way? Because, you know, some of these other agencies are pretty big and some of them actually spend all their time in the fashion space. And they're like, we loved that you both have a shit ton of experience, that you're fun and made us laugh, and that we knew we could go fast and we could be experimental. Like we wouldn't need to follow a process. We could do what we collectively all wanted to do. And I think that's a lot awesome. Of clients are feeling a little bit manhandled by their agencies, and maybe feeling a little bit like there's a little too air in the balloon. Like, what are all these people doing again? And so sometimes I'll come in and we'll write the strategy. And then once the strategy is complete, the next question is, well, do you know people who can execute this? And I was like, yeah. Would you like to bring them in? Yeah, I would. Yeah, because I know them, I trust them, I know how many people I need, and they now trust me to direct them because we've been working on the strategy together for X number of weeks or months. And that has proven to be a model that I find a lot of clients are interested in. You know, they find a trusted leader with enough experience to like run independently and drive stuff. And a deep Rolodex of connections to like really talented people. Like, for example, in the H&M work, one of the assignments that we were given was to write the global PR strategy. I know enough about PR to get in trouble, but I don't know enough to write a global PR strategy for a fashion brand. So I needed to go find a baller. And so I found a woman, Dana Gers, and she came on board and she ran that work stream simultaneously while Britton and I were doing other bits. And she essentially is a peer. Like we were syncing up on the back channel. We were having text messages and she would say, oh, the PR team wants to go rogue over here. What should I do? And I'd be like, oh, well, we just developed this new piece of strategy here. Drop these three slides in there and it'll help her get back in line. So it was great to have a really senior partner. But then once that was done, she said, okay, cool. That's fun. Let's do it again sometime. And she went off to go do something else. And, it's been fun. I'm not an agency, although I behave sometimes familiarly like agencies do, but I try to think of it more like it's an idea. It's more like a collective. I haven't really landed the right words, honestly. If you know a really good copywriter, maybe we could break it down sometime. But
we do actually. We can give you his details. Yeah. What's his name?
I'm trying to invent my own language around some of these things so that I don't get preconceived expectations that I'm going to do what somebody else does who uses those same words, kind of introduce new language.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you can't be good at everything. Like some people are just, otherwise you're just sort of neutral. That's why you sort of chime in. That's the same with us. Like we chime into people, our external sort of collaborators and partners that come in and support us on projects because we are physically trained in something else.
Yeah, I think the power of what you do is first and foremost leadership. Mm-hmm. And so that when you do pull people into the sphere who need to roll out a PR strategy, if they're good enough and have the sense, they will follow your lead and they'll trust your lead and they'll deliver their best work. I think that's the big thing. I think drawing a parallel to Play & Co, to Karen's point, we have specialists in the Play & Co solar system who we could never afford to hire full time, like a 3D knit specialist that knows stole machines. Mm-hmm. And she worked on a 2-year project for us. And we're like this, you know, so we can do work that maybe larger agencies couldn't do because we can tap into these unique skill sets. And I think that's what you're highlighting there. So
yeah, in a funny way, I'm a bit of It's funny. I'm like an introvert, but I'm also a social butterfly, and I don't know why how those two things work together sometimes. But I like to spend a lot of time by myself. It's kind of fun working from home. I don't mind it at all.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm actually through the computer connecting with people quite a lot, and I have a lot of connections that I try to maintain from people I've worked with over the years. And interestingly, I've been able to kind of pull it into my work. And a lot of the different assignments that I do, I will sometimes have a chapter of the work that's around expert voices. And I've found a really interesting digital platform that I started using during COVID because it was necessary, but now I really love it, where I can do an asynchronous interview with somebody. I can preload a question. It's a talking head of me saying, here's question number one. What do you think about X? And then on their side, they see that question played to them as a video and they get a chance to kind of think about it for a minute. And then they press a button and they respond. And they send a video clip back to me, a talking head clip back. And so I was able to do like a really big piece for the Oatly Futures Lab, the innovation lab, around culture hacking and what was coming around the corners of different cultural drivers. And I was able to pull in people that I used to work with in Europe, or a couple futurists that I've been working with here in the States on some side projects, and get their expert voices, like literally dropped into the presentation that was going to go to the CEO to say, it's not just us, what we're reading. Of course, we're capable, we're experienced, we're analyzing the right data. But when you also ask these other experts who are also doing the work from slightly different vantage points, we're all seeing similar themes. And then it like adds another layer of like gravitas around sort of like the data. And it's been super fun. I haven't been able to actually pull them physically into a room yet. That's kind of like a goal I have of mine, is some brand out there somewhere will be like, I want to do this in person. I want these human beings with me and my team physically for a day or half a day. And we want to break it down together. But I've managed to do it asynchronously in a way that's still like has some power in it. Yeah, and I know some really cool people, and I just want to like, more people need to hear their voices, and more people need to understand their thinking, because it's really juicy. And yeah. Ryan's one of those people, actually. Ryan Coulter, he's a gem.
Cool. Absolutely. And you know what, that brings up a really good point, Katie. You know, what you do, they don't teach in school. I mean, maybe some groundwork, basic, you know, corporate this, business school that, but you're constantly shape-shifting, much like the logo on your website. So what do you look for towards for inspiration and keeping one foot ahead in your line of work? Because it's so critical, not just for you and the value you bring to your clients, but I mean, it just seems like it's a whole part of your personality. So where does Katie get that awesome juice?
Where do I get some of that Katie juice?
At the Awesome Juice store. Yeah, there's this plant in, you know, Lower Slobovia called the Awesome Juice plant, and it makes like a berry, and like somebody's harvesting it. Let's see, how do I begin on that one? To get my wheels turning, I just read a ton of fiction, mostly science fiction, if I'm honest. I'm super, super geeky, and I don't hide it anymore. I remember I used to kind of hide it a little bit, so I didn't want to scare people, but I don't care anymore. Like, be scared, don't be scared, whatever. I'm super stoked on it. And I had a really interesting conversation with a friend just last week who's organizing a think tank around AI, and it's his opinion, and I think it's good opinion, that really the conversation around AI is focusing on the wrong things right now. And he really wants to force business leaders, governments, et cetera, to kind of consider other avenues of thought that are being ignored at the moment. And we had a really funny, like, you know, one of those little eureka moments that are kind of quiet but powerful, where we're like, I feel like I've read so many science fiction novels in which AI is being applied as a very subtle layer of the narrative or of character development in such a way that part of my brain already knows what it's supposed to be doing and believes that it could and should be doing those things. And so when I read about you know, AI is writing people's term papers. It's like, yeah, but it's not really supposed to be doing that. Like, it's supposed to be navigating the stars, or it's supposed to be like crunching scientific data that helps us beat disease, or helping with harvests and, you know, in regenerative agriculture. So like, I have a feel, like I just read one this morning about like recycling plants. It's so hard to do really well with recycling because the machines currently available can't sort. Oh, if we got an AI in there, we could sort and we could have better, you know, so like we're baby stepping our way into it. But I, long story short, I feel like I read a shit ton of science fiction, and it feeds my brain in a way that like regular fiction can't. And like Ursula Le Guin is a big one. And Kim Stanley Robinson. And right now I'm reading William Gibson because he freaks me out, but it's all good. And that's one way, storytelling, essentially imagining. Yeah. And I think if my work, well, some of my most fun pieces of work have been about the combination of those two things. I was very, very lucky really early on at Nike. I think it was 2014. I worked on an assignment internally that was trying to imagine the year of 2020, and what consumer engagement was going to be like 6 years into the future. And who, I mean, 2020 ended up being like a completely different future, obviously. But at that time, like Uber was really big, Airbnb was really big. It was all about the disruption of like previous systems. And my partner and I on that assignment, Josh Moore, he had taken a design course in which he went to design school. And one of the professors, guest professors who came in was Bruce Sterling, the science fiction author, who's also a designer. And he's like, wouldn't it be cool if we worked with a science fiction author? And I was like, okay, I'm going to figure this out. And so I started looking around, who would I want to work with? Who had actually already done some science fiction around like the body and sport? There had been some really interesting writings being done around like, what's the future of the marathon? If the planet is hotter, is the marathon in Oslo? We can't actually marathon in San Francisco anymore. It's too hot. What do people wear? How do they train? Do they live in apartments that can, you can seal it off and now you're sleeping and living at a different altitude, blah, blah, blah. But I ended up calling Bruce Sterling, and Bruce Sterling worked with us, and we co-authored with him a presentation that we delivered to Mark Parker and his executive leadership team that was about what we thought the future was going to look like. And it ended up really kicking off a ton of work streams internally, not to make that vision happen precisely, but just because we had convinced them that it was on its way and that it was part of our responsibility as an innovation company to be at the beginning of that.
I'm fascinated with the presentation moment to Mark Parker and this engagement with Bruce Sterling. Like, what did it look like? Was it storyboards? Was it this beautiful kind of presentation? Like, how did I know creatives would be kind of really curious to know what goes into a presentation like that.
Some of that was dictated. It was part of this particular moment doesn't happen anymore at Nike, but at the time it was called SPKO, the Strategic Priorities Kickoff. It happened once a year, and it was the very first strategic gate at the most highest level of the company from which everything else cascaded down in annual planning. So at this offsite, which is at like a winery out here in Oregon and wine country, teams were created. In this case, our team was the CMO, the CFO, and the GM who was over all of the vertical GM business units. Those three people were tasked with coming back to Mark and the entire room to present back and say, what does the future of consumer engagement look like in the year 2020? I was working in brand marketing at the time, and I was in the brand innovation team. And so I got pulled together with a working team of folks that were from these three senior leaders teams. We were told, you're not going to get a big production budget. This needs to be lean and mean. There needs to be a presentation. So at Nike, that means a keynote. These senior leaders are also trying to impress each other, and they're trying to look good in front of their boss, Mark. So they're trying to create something that's flashy. So there was a very nuanced line to walk to make it feel incredible without spending a ton of money. And so I think, you know, we secured time with Bruce. He and I went back and forth over email. We had an editor in-house who pulled together imagery Bruce was in Italy at the time. And so once we had nailed the script, he recorded his voice in Italy. We took his VO and put it over the top of the edit. And then simultaneously was a good old fashioned keynote presentation that these three leaders were going to be presenting on the day in the room. None of the working team were allowed to be there. That was not for us to be there, but we were serving it up to them. And then we realized we were pulling into, through our research, we had pulled so many, I think it was like 80 or something, really cool case studies, but all these other examples of all these other businesses, whether they were a startup or a competitor, that were using these principles. So we made a booklet and we put it at the elbow of every single person who was going to be in the audience. So it was kind of a three-point, it was a presentation of film and a little booklet.
Very cool.
Yeah.
How long did that total process take? Was it the kind of thing where the CMO came to you and said, I got to present something in 2 weeks? Or they're like,
everybody knows this is coming. And yeah. The strategy group at Nike lets people know where the agenda is starting to coalesce. And then once teams are assigned, you're like racing to try to maximize the amount of time that you have. And so I think in the end, it was maybe 2 months.
Cool.
Something
still,
like that.
Still fast.
Yeah. I mean, it was maybe six to 8 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. You can fill that up pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember it well because it was over spring break and my spring break was very stressful that year.
Hopefully you were able to work remotely from Cabo or something with Sina Carada's boat.
We were in Arizona and I was trying to get her done from the poolside, but it was not a very restful period.
Maybe that pollutes your idea of working from anywhere, you know, because when Karen and I quit our job one time when we were really young, we tried working from a beach. I tried working freelance from a beach in Thailand and it was too hard because you're like looking out at the water, but you got to get work done.
But I have been testing the limits of the work from anywhere thing. We have a cabin up in Washington State and I've taken calls from the lodge off camera, obviously, but it's tricky to find a quiet place.
Yeah.
I've been, on the mountain, doing a status call, taking notes, participating, and then turning off my phone and clicking in and skiing, doing some laps on the mountains. We also did a hike in the Grand Canyon, and obviously not the Grand Canyon. That canyon's not wired, but the road trip out there, we wanted to drive out, was going to take several days. And I had calls lined up and we were crossing different state lines that had different time zones. Oh. And I'd look at the clock and be like, okay, before we cross the line into the next state, we got to pull over. I got to find a coffee shop with Wi-Fi. I got to do this call. And I would sometimes like buy a bunch of food at the coffee shop and ask them to turn the music down just a little bit and like try to make it work out and then hop back in the car and, you know, motor on and do it from, you know, hotel rooms and whatnot. I haven't figured out how to, I still get stressed about it. I haven't figured out how to be totally relaxed about it. Maybe I'll get there, but, or maybe it's just good to have a certain degree of anxiety. Maybe it just shows I care, but it's been fun to try to figure out how to do it.
You know, we were just, the three of us were having a discussion about that yesterday. And, you know, there's this whole like laptop, work from the coffee shop with a laptop mentality. But Karen just got a new Mac yesterday and it's a desktop. And we were talking about, you know, the portability because she's also out and about a lot. And I've been doing this a lot myself, but it's like I get so much of my core work done at home. And then the iPhone is just so powerful now that I can go on Figma, Slack, you know, all my communications apps. Yep. And as long as I'm out and about in the world, I can get enough done. But then when I come back, I make sure that I get that core work done at home. Mm-hmm. And it really helps with that, you know, work from home mentality versus having to lug a laptop around or thinking through it,
right,
thinking about it through that lens, which brings up another point about how you work, Katie, and your views on things. What are some other sort of digital or lifestyle or consumer transformations that you see on the not too distant horizon, just from like a global perspective, not like through a specific brand or anything, because at Play & Co, we have ethos centered around planet and people health. So a lot of the projects that we take on, if it doesn't fall into one of those lenses, or if we can't be an advisor to help, you know, make something more sustainable or make something that's good for the people, you know, we tend to turn those projects away. So you know, you also, you know, seem to have your own ethos system in terms of, you know, your background and the work you've done. So what is that like sort of next step into the future look like from your perspective in terms of like where brands are going, where behaviors are going? You don't have to divulge too many secrets, but just a little bit.
Yeah, and before you jump in, I think it's a great question, Simon. And one of the things I didn't get to highlight, you mentioned a term earlier about, you said culture hacking. And to me, that was fascinating because you're also talking about this asynchronous interview platform. And then my mind went to, well, pretty soon I should be able to get some kind of AI virtual assistant to do my interviews for me. And then where's the line, you know? So,
yeah. No, I think, AI is an obvious one. We're trying to figure out what is the appropriate use of AI and what is the non-extractive use of AI, because I can feel that the old guard, the old way of doing business, is already trying to figure out how they can maximize, optimize, make people desperately reliant on, you know, that sort of thing, and make it a gate-kept thing that people have to pay for, as opposed to applying it to all the realms in which our brain can't function. Like, I saw a really great interview recently with the NVIDIA CEO, and you've most likely seen the clip as well. It's been circulating a lot the last 10 days or so, where he's like, it used to be that you'd want to treat... get your kids into coding and make sure your kids know how to code. He's like, they don't need to know how to code. They need to be a subject matter expert. The AIs will be able to do the things they don't know how to do and optimize the hell out of the subject matter. So whether that's farming or whether that's handcraft or it's, you know, being a food expert and chef or some sort of business leader, you don't need to know how to code. The AI should be coded in such a way that it behaves like human language, and human language can drive it and can ask what it needs of it, as opposed to applying it in such a short-sighted way to the business mechanics that we have today. So I think we're in a lack of imagination right now. That's where I go to, again, science fiction as being like an incredible library, literal library of examples of a million different ways in which AI could be used in so much more inspired ways. I think kind of in tandem with that is what we're starting to see with the web, you know, the promise of the early web being this thing that was going to tie us together and was going to create a better world and was going to facilitate a lot of transparency and opening and learning. And some of that really did happen. But I think what's the cancer cell of what really did happen, though, is social media and how it was sold to us on a bad bill of goods. You know, that it was about connectivity and about family and friends, and it was about connections. It's not. It's not. Our attention was for sale and it's been sold. And our psychology has been damaged in the process. I have two teen kids, and the statistics that you as a parent read about, just on how my daughter literally said to me, I wish I grew up like you did, Mom.
Yeah.
Before the internet, before a phone, just riding your bike around. Like, that sounds really fun. Yeah. You know, so I think we've really taken something important away from youth. Mm-hmm. And I just want to grieve about it. Like, it's so awful. And so I see a lot of conversation about what the future of the internet could be or should be, even conversations that are really interesting about just completely jumping out of the pool and leaving the internet altogether and having it become a big empty room, which is a fascinating idea because it's so full of action right now. And I used to work like in, what was it, 1998, I worked at a digital firm in Seattle where I was literally calling companies and who did not have a website and we were going to create their very first website. We're going to host it, set them up with a maintenance plan and a webmaster. And it's just like now, like each individual, I myself as a person, I have my own website. You know, like back then, Starbucks didn't have a website. Like we made it for them. So it's come a long way, but it lost its way along the way. And I think there's work to be done. If the internet is going to persist in the way that we understand it, you've probably heard the term cozy web being bandied about, and like ideas of like smaller niche communities breaking down these gigantic cruise ship monoliths of Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and people kind of abandoning them for smaller and more intimate communities. Slack and Discord have been platforms that have kind of facilitated that sort of experience. I myself am a part of some really like niche Discord servers. One, I'm actually going to fly to San Francisco on Thursday in a couple days to go see Dune 2 at the IMAX, which was organized by the Discord server founders, because they had a podcast called Dune Pod that they've been doing for the past 2 years. And it is super geeky. And I've only met one person out of all of these people. And so I am a person who is living in the cozy web right now and really enjoying it. But if you start thinking about like physical objects and production of things and goods for sale, and a lot of my experience has been in apparel and footwear or fashion or outdoor, which involves like making something that you put on your body, which is a really intimate act. And also depending upon the activity you're planning to do, it can be really closely tied to like your identity and goals and performance and progress and a lot of like really emotional territories to play around in. But the reality is anytime you make something, you're taking something from the planet, and there's no escaping that. It's just physics. Like there's nothing you can do about it. And at least not yet. And Patagonia, you know, so memorably in the last year said, we are not a sustainable company. But just to kind of make the point that oftentimes people point to them as being angelic in some way. And it's like, no, we're just as extractive as anybody else. The only difference is we've given our business to our foundation so that all of our income is actually going to go do some work to try to like save the planet in the process, take what we know how to do and do well with it. And they've also spun out Provisions, which is probably where Patagonia Provisions, where the real good of Patagonia will come to fruition, because they're actually dealing in a truly regenerative space, which is around agriculture. But I'm talking to some really interesting companies lately. I had dinner with, the CEO of Houdini Sportswear. Last time I was in Sweden, her name's Ava Carlson. She's awesome. And they've been doing some fun stuff around subscription. It works really well for their kit in particular, because it's high performance equipment for extreme environments, but also incredibly beautifully made in the sense that you can walk around downtown Stockholm or wherever you are and look really stylish and really happy with how you look. And so it has the ability to kind of code switch a little bit, these pieces. But they recognize if you're a skier and maybe you are only going to go up a couple times a year, why do you need to buy new gear? And why can't you just borrow it? And so they've introduced subscription into their products, which make a ton of sense. They've also did a partnership this year, which was really cool, with one of the local Swedish ski hills, where if you're going to be flying out, if you're going to be renting your equipment, why don't you rent your ski kit too? And so they had Houdini equipment up there that you would go skiing in. So literally you could fly from New York to Stockholm, take a tiny little plane up to the ski hill. Everything's there for you in your room. Ski for a couple of days, you give it back. You don't even have to pack a big bag. You can just bring a backpack. So it's like,
wow.
There's some really interesting ideas about borrowership versus ownership, which is really compelling. And On Running is doing a similar thing with their Cyclone shoe, where you never own it. You pay a subscription fee, you run in it, you run it down, you send it back, a new one comes. You run in that one, you run it down, you send it back, a new one comes. And they've created a closed loop as much as is possible right now on the back end to reclaim the used shoe and put it into a new shoe. So there's signs of like, even physical objects that go on your body, which previously were like, you can't share that. You know, you can't
share
borrow
my
that. But yeah, that underwear is probably not going to go. But like, but some of these other ones, particularly if it's something you're not going to use every day, like it's really seasonal or it's special equipment for special moments, or even like Rent the Runway, where they had high-end gala dresses, you know, prom dresses or wedding dresses and things you're going to wear once or a handful of times. Like there's really great examples of doing more with what's already been created. It's already been extracted, so let's not waste it. Mm. And then the return. And then probably the last thing I'll say is a family member lives up in Canada and has several boats and runs an organization with his partner. It's called Ocean Plastics Recovery Project, and they're pulling plastic out of the ocean up there by the ton, and they're actively searching for product makers or like idea makers, creatives who want to create with that material, or an established brand who's like, I can actually switch out virgin plastic and use this recycled plastic instead. And I think there's going to be more and more of that happening.
We should definitely talk to them, because I think a lot of our clients could push some applications there for sure.
His name is Andy Schroeder, and I will introduce you very happily.
Yes, please. That's awesome. Yeah. When you were speaking about Houdini and this experience of flying directly to the slopes, to me, there's a service model, but what you framed up was a beautiful little experience, more than the service model, more than the pragmatic kind of rationalization that, oh, I don't need to buy my own snow gear. Like the moment that you can sell me that this experience is going to be better than forking out $1,000, $2,000 on gear that I'm only ever going to use once a year, and store in the garage or something like that. That gets that's the opportunity, I think, for leaders like yourself and to influence companies to design better experiences, to make those experiences more compelling than the alternative, the current status quo. So
it's a heavy dose of storytelling, I've noticed, is a part of the approach, which might come from a lot of the science fiction stories you've been reading. But Katie, just to close things out, you mentioned you have two young adult aged about children. For this current generation, I don't know if Generation Alpha is the right term for it, but anybody that's sort of like in that realm of late teenager to early 20s, trying to like figure out what's coming up, like where do I apply myself for a career, like where do I what do I want to study in school, from this futurist approach that you have, that you're literally hired to deliver on by large Fortune 100 companies, what sort of advice or tea would you give these people, or any, but maybe even somebody older that's looking for a more optimistic look at the future? Is there just like a canned version of something you might tell them?
I think, at the most macro level, I think the most important skill anybody can pick up right now is the ability to be agile and nimble and adaptable, because whatever anybody's parents may have told them about the way the world works, or the way the world has always worked, I think there's going to be a lot of confronting changes that are going to take place. There's going to be some tension, some social tension, some environmental tension. There's going to be COVID, having to take, do school at home. Like there's going to be things big and small. And if you don't let it rock your boat too much, you're going to be okay. And the most important thing, as a parent, you're like, I just want my children to be happy. I want to give them the skills necessary that whatever gets thrown at them, whatever comes along, that they can maintain their center and they can maintain their happiness and the joy of being alive, and the joy of living a life and all of its magic and all of its mundanity, And my older daughter, she's very academic. She's always been very very focused. She's gotten really into biology. She's choosing to study marine biology, which is really exciting. We're here near the coast. And she's also very obviously aware that, like, this is work that is important. It's also work I really like, but it's work that the world needs right now. And it adds like another layer of like gravitas to doing it. And which I think she's really, maybe at first was a little shy of, or a little, maybe daunted by, but now has become very, it's become part of her identity, which is kind of fun to see her slowly like leaning into the lab and like all of this stuff. My son is less academic and he's more into sport, and he's had some learning challenges. And so for him, it's been more about, where does the world need people that know how to do the things that you do? And also to not sell yourself too short on like what the world is going to need in terms of new capabilities. And he went up and worked on the boat with our family member in Kodiak last summer and pulled tons of plastic out of the ocean. And he was part of a crew with college students and a scientist from Shell who was there to analyze the product. And they all gave each other presentation. I mean, it was a very formative experience for him. He was essentially up there as like labor. He was like pulling these big containers on the boat and everything. But he came home, I could see, like, with a new understanding of like, science is also labor, and some of the most important work that people are going to do is not behind a computer. And he and I are going to actually take a generative AI workshop together next month. From an artist who has been, I follow her on Instagram and I'm blown away by what she's able to do. So we're going to do that together so we can talk about prompts and how, and I gave him my company logo and set him up on one of the AI like little machines that are out there on the internet. So you can kind of play around with stuff. And he made me a bunch of really cool imagery that I'm going to use now when I'm doing some writing later this summer. So I think for him, he's not going to be really drawn to like the traditional setup world as it stands right now. He's going to, I don't know, find his way into something. I grew up going to school in the state. I moved into Auburn, Washington when I was 5 years old, and I grew up from Auburn High School. And then I went down up the road to Seattle and went to the University of Washington. And the first time I moved away from the 206 area code on my phone was when I moved to Amsterdam, and I had a 2 and a 5-year-old in tow. Like, so for me, I spent a lot of time in one area, but my kids, we moved them from Amsterdam to Sydney, to Portland, to Tokyo, Japan, back to Portland again. And each time, like, they needed to make new friends. We needed to figure out the neighborhood, the public transport, the schools. That sometimes there was uniforms, sometimes there wasn't. Sometimes there was foreign language, sometimes there wasn't. I sometimes worry that they're going to need therapy because I move them around so many times. But actually, I only worry about that, I think, now. I've been talking to some friends about it because it's different from my own experience. They actually had their own. And my daughter actually wrote a lot about it in her college application stuff. So I think, in a way, without intending it this way, I may have actually given them some good fuel for being adaptive and being kind of malleable to circumstances and being observant and learning how to say hello in someone else's language and da, 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 like all these things that you just naturally do when you're the visitor. And they think a lot about what other people's experiences are like. And some of those skills now I think are just become more and more important. So I don't know. I think more at the base level, you just need to be able to, I feel like, understand yourself emotionally and psychologically, understand what you're good at and what you're not good at, understand that the world's going to be weird, and to kind of, if you can, enjoy it. Because I think it's stressful for those of us who are older, because when things wiggle around and shake, it breaks stuff. And that feels like maybe that's a negative thing, but actually, you know, breaking is not always bad. Like there's actually a lot of structure in our world that is not actually helping people. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. And sometimes you don't see it until it's broken. And then you're like, wait a minute, why was this ever functioning like this in the first place? You know, so I think there's gonna be some good that comes from the rubble. And so I welcome the earthquakes. Sounds crazy to say that, but I'm kind of excited by it as well as trying to get ready for it.
If you want to continue the conversation, share your thoughts, or suggest topics for future episodes, be sure to connect with us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn at PlanCo, or visit planco.com. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and until next time, keep playing, keep designing, and keep pushing the boundaries of what's next. This is Play In Conversations, signing off.